Hello there. I'm Douglas Harding, the designer of your Universe Explorer. It comes from me personally, and it's addressed to you personally, at your full address. You'll see what I mean if you look at the Cosmoscope, which is also the mailing tube in which the model arrived. Now, it comes to you telling its own story, without too much further explanation from me, I hope. Anyway, I do suggest you delay playing this tape till you've done quite a bit of exploring on your own. Not that it'll be all that easy. You see, this universe is designed to put questions and not so much to hand out ready-made answers. Really, it's made up of puzzles, and the more solutions you come up with, why, the more they'll mean to you. And, of course, the more fun you'll have. And when you do come to play this tape, take as much or as little as you want. It's an accessory, not a component. Okay, then? Well, I hope you had an interesting look around the universe and you're now well-placed to handle it and examine its details. Well, first I'd like to tell you why I devised the model in the first place, and about some of the discoveries I've made with its help. Then you and I'll do some universe exploring together. And after that, why, you're the crew's captain, and quite likely will find your way into regions I know little of. For me, it all began rather suddenly, when I realised with a shock that it actually happened. It seemed a great thing to have occurred. Chances seemed all against my coming into existence, or at any rate, all against my turning out to be me, if you see what I mean. Still, I'd made it. Goodness knows how or why. What's more, I hadn't made it as just any old thing. What had occurred was alive and awake enough to be surprised at itself, and able to ask itself what, against all the odds, had happened. It seemed to me a shocking waste to live and die without ever bothering to look who's doing so. Not taking someone else's word for it, but daring to look at myself for myself, with no firm ideas about what I'd find. So I put this Universe Explorer together to help me pose this most exciting of all questions. What am I? And to record some of the provisional answers I was getting. In spite of its limitations, I find the device more than enough to keep me on my toes. It nudges me, it digs me sharply in the ribs sometimes, and helps me stay awake. Awake to how little I know about that chap I see in my mirror. Awake to the need to place myself in the cosmos. Awake to the mystery and wonder of my meaning and origin and destiny, of my true nature, my nature and your nature, the wonder and mystery that I very much want to share with you now. Let it not be said of you and me, in the words of L.P. Jacks, they do not bother about the universe, having more important affairs to look after. Well, they know, of course, their place on the map, but in the universe they're completely lost. I, too, had been lost. But this universe model came to my rescue. It turned out to be, as its name implies, and you can see, a model of the world itself. I mean the whole works, the cosmos, including me. In fact, finding out about myself was finding out about the cosmos, and vice versa. I'm speaking of the cosmos as it actually presents itself, as it's served up and experienced in practice. Not as we've come to think of it. A cosmos arranged like a nest of spheres around this center, right here. A cosmos that's much more like a many-layered onion than the monolithic, coreless potato we've been told it is. So I found this concentric model, this large-scale onion, really valuable, and certainly too useful to keep to myself. Which brings me to you. Now, how shall we use our Universe Explorer for tackling this tremendous question? What are you really? Let's begin by agreeing you are, among other things, what you look like. You're how you strike others. Also, you're what you look like to yourself when, as we say, you look at yourself through others' eyes. Dead easy, you may say. I look like a human being, a person. And that's precisely what I am. Okay, so far, certainly to your friends, you look human all right. But that's because they keep their distance. Nearer to, you look like something else. Further away, like something very different again. Do you remember what happened when Alice, in Through the Looking Glass, started going up to the Red Queen? The Rose, who was standing by, said she couldn't do that. Nonsense, retorted Alice, and went on approaching the Red Queen. And lost her. The lady vanishes. To find her again, Alice must come away. And the same thing would have happened if Alice had been photographing the Red Queen. Holding the camera 10 feet away, she'd have got a picture of the royal lady all complete. Holding it 3 feet away, a royal face. Holding it a fraction of an inch away and using the right lenses, a very unroyal living creature called a cell. You'll find some sample cells on vein 6 of your universe. And still closer, she'd have got pictures of even humbler beings. And in the end, at the point of contact, pictures of a blank, of nothing at all, as that transparent ball at the centre of the model suggests. Now, just supposing that Alice, instead of going up to Her Majesty and losing her, had gone away from her, while still pointing the camera at exactly the same spot. Well, I guess her pictures would have shown a countryside all set out in squares, and then a colourful country, an ocean-girt continent, the Earth itself, the solar system, and so on, retreating as far into the distance as her spacecraft would carry her. Alice would again have found herself taking blank photos. You'll notice how your Universe Explorer, and particularly the outsides of the veins, gives an impression of these magical transformations. Like that other queen, Cleopatra, your variety is infinite. That familiar face of yours is only one of your innumerable appearances at various distances. To say nothing of your disappearances at no distance and at infinity. I see you as a great magician who, outdoing Merlin himself, is constantly changing shape and, as a crowning exhibition of wizardry, vanishing without trace into thin air. William Blake had a very good way of putting it. Mountain, hill, earth, and sea, cloud, meteor, and star, are men seen afar. If you modestly reply that really you're quite small and stuck with a human face right where you are, why then I'd ask you to take another look at the place you occupy. A long, hard look. Now. Well, you're the only one who has access to the spot, and if you can't report on it, nobody can. But let me put some questions to you. Why is it that to discover if your hair's tidy or your nose shiny, you have to hold a mirror out there and locate a face in it? If all the while you have another face at the near end of your outstretched arm. Can you be sure at this moment about the state of your hair or your makeup? On the inside of vein 5, I've indicated that you'll find your face out there among the others, if you find it at all. Isn't this where you keep the thing? Which reminds me of the small girl who, when sent to the bathroom to wash that dirty face, started washing the face of that little girl in the mirror. Her own face, what face? Being spotless, clean, not merely of dirt, but of skin itself. Of everything. Now there's a clear complexion for you. Well, no doubt that small girl's more practical now she's grown up. But less truthful. Does she really think she can free that face of glass and enlarge it at least 3 times and twist it round 180 degrees and bring it 18 inches forward? And plant it firmly on her shoulders? Why, not even Merlin could do all that. But all she's got to do, you may tell me, is to feel the thing, filling up the seeming emptiness in the middle of her world. Good point. But can she fill that central gap? Can you fill yours? Please try fingering and prodding your own face now, all over. Go on, please. See if you can build on your shoulders any sort of headquarters, let alone something opaque and solid and coloured and hairy, Caucasian or whatever, handsome or ugly, clean or dirty. And having built and thatched and furnished your round house, take up residence, and then tell me what it's like indoors. Is it small, damp, stuffy, cramped, dimly lit by 2 small windows? Just look and see, and count those windows from inside. Now. Isn't it a fact that what you were getting here was simply a succession of touch sensations, which certainly aren't hairy or brown or black or pale pink? Touch sensations that are no more substantial than the tastes and smells and sounds which are coming and going in the same emptiness, all of them leaving you as wide open and clear and boundless as when you were little and you had a playmate who lived in that other bathroom behind the looking glass. Well, you're the expert on what it's like where there's no one but you. Your Universe Explorer is for pointing you back to your own experience. It invites you and me to see what we see instead of what we ought to see. At this point, you may remind me that seeing isn't everything. You can't always go by appearances. And that really, you are what you feel like. And you feel like a person. I reply, why, of course you do. And so do I. But not all the while. Why have so many ordinary, naturally selfish people actually chosen to suffer and die as people for their country or their gods or mankind, if they were only mere private citizens? Conversely, how could you find yourself narrowing down to, say, an aching tooth, if you were never less than a whole human? At other times, don't you find yourself in a more expansive mood and naturally identifying with and thinking and feeling and acting for your family or your football team or city or church as the occasion demands, so smoothly you don't notice switching. And in the event of real Star Wars, wouldn't you catch yourself trembling and triumphing with the varying fortunes of your planet and your own solar system, even your own galaxy? And haven't there been moments when you're so in love with the world that you feel like flinging your arms around it all, when without warning you grow so big-hearted that you truly feel yourself to be the universe, correctly spelt our way, YOUNIVERSE? And finally, for contrast, aren't there occasions when you feel like nothing on Earth, nothing whatever, when all you want to do is stop the world and get off? Surely the truth is that you're as big or as small as you feel. There's nothing you can't take on and shed. And if you were still to doubt the evidence of your senses, plus your feelings, plus your behaviour, you could appeal to common sense for its final verdict on what you really amount to. You could ask what you need to be you, how much of the cosmos it takes to set up this one human being. What are you without your underpinning of cells and molecules and atoms and particles, your subhuman resources, your filling or stuffing, so to speak? Again, try being human without humanity, independent of your own species. Or try being alive without the other species, without your planetary life. You could survive with one kidney and half your respiratory system and no limbs at all. But how long could you survive without your solar system? If you're a whole, then you're the whole. Quite rightly, you're sure you're an individual and all there, which can only mean that you can't be less than the universe spelled our way. Congratulations. Well, that'll do for our preliminary exploration of the universe. To get the feel of it and know our way round a bit, it's high time we set out on our step-by-step Cook's tour, giving more attention to the passing scene. Remember, the purpose of our tour is to find out what you look like at different distances, to help us to be open-minded and prepared for anything. Let's pretend we're visitors from another dimension, visiting this universe for the very first time. And we'll commence as far away as possible and travel inwards towards the centre, your centre. Are we ready to begin with the model well lit and placed before us as our navigational aid? We start so far away and long ago that there's nothing at all to see, not a speck. At this point, I'd like to put a question to you. Why should anything happen? Why does there have to be anything at all? It seems to be natural and only to be expected that nothing should occur. In other words, I feel that quite the most strange and thrilling thing about the universe isn't what it is, but that it is. It got off its own launching pad with no outside help. After this impossibility, tell me what isn't possible. Somehow I find this very encouraging. Oh well. Whether incredible or inevitable, something's beginning to happen at last in our empty space. Creation's afoot. The darkness is becoming peppered with tiny specks of light. Around the centre of the scene, some of them are growing brighter and moving apart, an explosion in slow motion. Now, one of them's becoming very bright indeed. It's ousting all the others. It's taking shape. Yes. It's a beautiful whirlpool of light, a streaming spiral of luminous dust, endlessly turning round its own bright centre. Here it is, your own galaxy, the Milky Way, pictured on the outside of Vane 1. Seen from this range, I must say you're very fine indeed. But I can't help wondering whether you don't find that smooth and unvarying dervish dance in the sky rather monotonous. Anyhow, let's get better acquainted. Let's take a closer look at this shining dancer. We start zooming in. But no, it's the story of the Red Queen all over again. The spiral vanishes. It looks as if our apparently substantial sky dancer was more like a mirage, after all, a surface without depth. Pretty much like our picture on Vane 1. If it was you at all, perhaps it was a ghost of you. Well, never mind. What's left is beautiful and brilliant enough. Among the scattered debris of the late dancer, a rotating disk, a great luminous ball of yellow-hot stuff, is taking over. And now we can just make out that the disk is ringed with faint circles of bluish and reddish and yellowish light, at least eight of them, widely placed. I only show the smaller rings on the outside of Vane 2. And now here's something really amazing. This creature is actually singing. Believe it or not, actually singing. Ever so faintly, with many hiccups and squeaks and howls and wheezings, but still singing. And simultaneously, it's engaged in an unending monologue, scarcely audible and quite unintelligible, but enough to prove we got a living creature here, all right. Do I hear you disagreeing? What's this about our picking up on our super-sensitive radio human voices? I can't see any humans. Remember, we're first-time universe visitors, strangers in a very strange world. Taking what we find in each region and not anticipating regions ahead. And here we have a star performer. And it's not only bad manners, but bad sense to deny to an artist of any rank the credit or the blame for his or her performance, and award it to selected and quite invisible bits of the artist's anatomy. Well, let's take a closer look at our star singer approaching, not for heaven's sake, that burning, fiery heart, but the third ring out, the faint blue one. It looks nice and cool and inviting, and now it's happening again. The celestial disappearance act. We've lost that burning core, and even the blue circle has suddenly melted away. And what's left isn't a vast ring, but a tiny spinning ball, growing fast. Just look, what a gorgeous, colourful creature we have here. Up to now, our universe has been pretty much a black and white affair, with some sparks of colour glinting in the luminous dust of the galaxy. But now it's blossoming into full colour, as you can see on Vane 3. And what a difference it makes. Here's an unusual, rugged, chaotic beauty. No straight lines, no symmetry, no regular features on your Earth face. I wonder, do these wry features express, or do they hide, their owner's astounding vitality? You ask for evidence of that vitality? Well, for a start, just listen to her. The music's coming through loud and clear now. Music of many themes and moods and tones of voice. All put out, can you believe it? simultaneously. What virtuosity! To sing 100 songs at once without getting them mixed up. Of course, we have to choose between them. To listen at one at a time. But she's not limited like that. What stamina! What lust of life! Incidentally, there's one song she must be specially proud of. She actually calls it her song. The Song of the Earth. Just as impressive as her musical gifts are her mathematical ones. Oh, don't mistake the regularity of her movements, of her steady spinning and her well-scheduled flight in the heavens, for mechanicalness. Unlike most creatures, she knows exactly what she's up to and where she's going and when and at what speed. Even the subtler variations in her dance routine are deliberate. Her mathematical account of them is a model of accuracy. But all very cold and calculating, you may comment. Has this prodigy any feelings? Is she ever moody, or sad, or elated? Well, if her poetry is any clue, I reply, and some of it, she admits, is autobiographical, then her emotional life is rich enough, I'd say. Or you tell me I've simply been listening to radio programs about astronomy and about the poetry of Wordsworth and Walt Whitman, George Meredith, Rilke and others who talk about the living Earth. This isn't a planet talking, it's people, you say. And I reply, the moment you produce these people, I'll take them seriously. Meantime, here's our beautiful, brilliant planet, patiently waiting to be noticed. May I remind us both of the consequences of treating her like dirt? Yes, like dirt. Of taking personal credit for her life and mind. And reducing her to an inert, exploitable, pollutable thing, to a mere space platform to which alien but highly superior beings are clinging. And what about the psychological consequences of sitting firmly on and repressing unwelcome aspects of oneself? Going unconscious is at least as harmful at our planetary level as any other. I say going unconscious, because it's not so long ago when Mother Earth wasn't only experienced as alive, but venerated as holy. But let's move on to a really close view of her, contenting ourselves with a few more findings on the way. Now here's a nice one. We find her watching and weighing up and placing her companions in the sky. For this last, she naturally needs binocular vision, eyes set wide apart in her face. And these she has grown, quite recently. And for placing remoter company, eyes no less than 200 million miles and 6 months apart, on opposite sides of her annual orbit. Well, we're welcome to call these truly superhuman sense organs observatories, manned telescopes, or anything else, provided we don't blind her, or rather ourselves, with our science. Not the science, actually, but words. And to match these planetary sense organs, and she's got several other sorts, is her planetary self-awareness or body consciousness. She's very much alive to her anatomy, her physiology, the long history of her development from the very beginnings of planetary life, her prospects for future maturing, her expectation of life, the manner of her inevitable death. And it takes a very alive mortal to contemplate so objectively its own mortality. still count her dead for her lack of vital statistics, for being pot-bellied and limbless and dreadfully fixed in her habits? Why then, for heaven's sake, let's propose some specific improvements, real evidences of life. What about a nice pair of flapping wings and a set of gleaming white teeth and an occasional holiday from spinning or a stroll away from or towards the sun? But enough of this nonsense. Everything about her is just right for life where she lives it. If there's to be a living, intelligent creature in the heavens, it's just got to be something like this. But now, alas, Earth's on the way out. We're zooming in again, and she's going, gone. And here's something that couldn't be more different. You'll see my impression of the thing on the outside of Vane 4, or rather the small part of the thing. At first sight, this flattened-out, plant-like object looks even less promising than the robustly globular planet did when we first encountered her. But it does have many intriguing features. Thus, for the first time during our inward journey, here are straight lines and regular geometrical patterns. More commonly, however, the thing takes irregular forms, shapeless, web-like nuclei, connected by fine, creeping, straggling, branching threads. Incidentally, it looks as if it doesn't like large areas of blue or yellow or white, but thrives wonderfully on greenish terrain. And thrives is the word, because it's alive all right. Though in places there's some withering and dying off, much more of the network is fast becoming more complex, sending out many vigorous feelers into new areas and thickening old ones. But if it's alive and flourishing like this, it must be getting its nutrition somehow. Probably, like Earth, drinking in sunlight all the time, but also, apparently, sending down many roots, roots big and small, shallow and very deep, into the blue and yellow terrain as well as the green. But on the whole, a rather dull creature, don't you think? But wait, come the night, and what a transformation! It turns into something like the starry sky above. In places it far outshines the constellations, and certainly outpaints them. Zooming in the dark now towards a network on Vane 4, the whole scene becomes a vast array of self-luminous jewellery, rubies, emeralds, sapphires, and above all diamonds, all breathtakingly beautiful. Surely the most spectacular of all living things. Let's move in a bit and see what's going on. It's surprise after surprise, as we make out its many strange and often winged moving parts, the ceaseless flow of metallic objects along its veins, its terrible and slow-to-heal gaping wounds, the mess of its many sorts of excreta, the nasty smell it has in places, and, of course, its relentless chatter, its non-stop crooning, its sheer, unremitting noise, audible excreta to supplement the visible and smellable sorts. But once more, of course, we find it terribly difficult to look at this phenomenon with an open mind and innocent eye. Again, we tell ourselves that the real life and mind we're getting all this evidence of don't belong to the creature we're looking at now, but to certain as yet invisible particles or corpuscles deep inside. To people. Well, instead of talking about people at a level where there aren't any, let's descend to their level and take a good look at one of these hidden corpuscles, a specimen person, and you, in fact, stripped of these so-called artificial coverings, a mere human. Oh, I don't find you at all mere. In fact, you had to be very unmere to live the life you do, to make it as any sort of human being, to make it at all. For a start, you aren't in the nude. I can't see the naked ape somebody said you were. He was speaking in biological terms. Okay, then let us do so. What are your chances of survival in this climate without these outer skins you call your clothes, and your insulated walls and ceiling and roof, not to mention your heating system? Again, what are your chances of survival in your present habitat if that small teeth-fringed slit in your head were your only mouth, your real mouth? You feed off the land still, of course. And all the better, too, because your jaws are reaping machines and munching cattle. And because your alimentary canal, with its preliminary stomachs, includes ships and docks and silos and mills and bakeries and warehouses and stores and a fridge and an oven, plus all the connections between them. Again, as of old, you excrete onto the land, of course. But if for that purpose you relied solely upon that short length of bowel you carry around with you, why, you would soon go down with typhoid. What in fact you do is at a moment's notice grow miles of additional bowel, which enables you to defecate safely at the sewage works, and then instantly and painlessly amputate it when you've done. Similarly, you do a million other human things, like drive nails and saw wood and write letters and cut paper and play music and fly off on a holiday and have a chat with friends 1,000 miles away, only by developing a special physique wonderfully fitted for each function in turn, and then immediately shedding it. To drive the nail, you suddenly develop a hard fist called a hammer. To fly, you evolve aluminium wings and tail. To run fast, you sprout wheels. To swim far, you streamline yourself for ocean life. To refresh your memory, you incorporate a library. But there's no end to your metamorphoses. What's a mere human? All around the flesh and blood core pulses this vast and unimaginably complex organism of yours, by virtue of which you survive and live the life you do live. This isn't your mere human body, it's your real human body. And it's none other than that strange creature that's figured in part on Vane 4, that lowly and neglected Cinderella, who nightly changes into a bejeweled princess, the shining face of humanity itself. But how, you may well ask, could a body made mostly of dead stuff like concrete and metal and brick and so on be half so alive as one made of flesh and blood? How could it be alive at all? The answer is that all living things, and certainly this flesh and blood of yours, are made up of lifeless bits and pieces. In particular of molecules, which consist of atoms, which consist of particles, as indicated, rather than pictured, on Vane 7 and 8 and 9. Life pops up when dead things set up in business together, and it packs up when the firm goes out of business and the members go their separate ways. Similarly, all those lifeless objects, from concrete blocks and undervests to computers and space stations, which go to make up your complete and fully human body, spring to life in that body. And that's no mere theory. The living, visible, audible, smellable proof is you yourself at a range of 20,000 feet, as pictured on Vane 4. So what? Perhaps for some time you've been feeling that, after all, we've only been looking at familiar things in an unfamiliar way, and that there's nothing really new here in this vision of Earth and humanity and people which could make much practical difference. Well, I think it would make a huge practical difference to see things this way. You see, for thousands of years, the wise have been saying that mankind is one, that life is indivisible, that war is suicide, that we must love one another or die, and that when I hurt you, I hurt myself, and that there is a realm where I am you. And now we're in desperate danger because we didn't take their message seriously. It was backed up by some powerful symbols and cogent arguments and great institutions, and many individual heroic deeds, and still we're at each other's throats. But at last something has happened, something quite new has happened, that's capable of bringing that perennial message home to us. We can actually see a good part of what those wise ones were talking about, and living by and dying for. Now we've got something that couldn't have happened before, an approach capable of firing the modern imagination and spelling out the ancient teachings in the language of our time. Thanks to the invention of aircraft and spacecraft, here is fresh evidence, something demythologized, concrete, direct, audible, convincing, and yes, superbly photogenic. Such seeing must be believing, given a little time for it to sink in. The direct vision of our common humanity from 10 kilometers away, and of our dear and splendid planet from 500,000 kilometers away. This isn't a vision likely to establish the kingdom of heaven on earth. Our ultimate wholeness and unity lie beyond those levels, but it is a vision that has already made a difference. Our universe explorer exists to sharpen that vision and bring out its meaning. Well, we've still got some way to go, as you'll see from the model, and it's too early to come to any firm conclusions. So let's get on. The closest we've come to you so far is around 5 feet, and that's a long way off. Let's zoom in till we're no more than a small fraction of an inch away. What do you like at this range? We find in our microscope a gaggle of those very alive and very non-human creatures called cells, a selection of which you'll see on vein 6. Further in, we get a pair of them. At this point, let's indulge in a little fantasy. These two cells are in earnest conversation. Cell A is commenting on the tremendous activity all around. He says it's all going on within and on account of a supernatural being called whatever your name is, Mary or John or whatever. Cells pushing and pulling and feeding and excreting, passing on messages, transporting goods, scavenging, on police duty, being born, dying. All, explains A, in the service of that great one. At the moment, the cellular scene is specially agitated. What's happening, he reveals, is that this transcendent person, in whom and for whom cells live, has just decided to what? To play table tennis. Oh, how speedily and efficiently the divine commands are handed down, interpreted and analysed, and parcelled out among groups and individuals, and put into effect. What marvels of cellular organisation are involved in just one swipe of the bat. Cell B regards Cell A as a woolly-minded visionary. Patiently he tells how he, Cell B, has travelled all over the universe, and never has he encountered anything but cells and their works, billions of individuals, dozens of species, every cell doing his thing, picking up a living as best he can. Never has Selby encountered a person, a godlike or supracellular being of any description, or detected the slightest sign that cells aren't practically the only form of life, and certainly the highest form of life. Soleil interrupts to say that this great being is invisible. She's real. So real, it's love of her that holds the entire cell world together and makes it go round. Soleil says, nonsense. It's every cell minding its own business. Soleil replies, why not both? Perhaps in the end they come to the same thing. But the debate continues. Of course, we can't really end our fantasy here at the comparatively exalted level of cells. We can equally imagine two molecules, A and B, having a similar argument about that great cellular divinity in whom A alleges molecules exist and move and have their being, and so on down the scale to atoms and particles and beyond. Oh, an increasingly crazy story, no doubt, but not such a bad way of bringing home one of the greatest puzzles our universe poses. Exploring our universe from the top down as sightseers, all very well, but how does the darn thing actually work? How's the business run? I'm not talking about the departmental organization, floor by floor. That's for the disciplines of science to tackle, but about the management as a whole, in depth. You'll get what I mean if you look at your hand now and suddenly move one of your fingers. Anyone. Please do that. Please. No big deal, you say. All right, then kindly tell me how you did it. You just made a wish and immediately it came true? And it was carried out by those obedient nerves and muscles? Well, it was actually their component cells that got down to work. No, it wasn't. It was their molecules. And so on down to the blue-collar boys on the shop floor of the universe who actually do the job. And who, if you please, are they? But this is looking ahead to the end of our journey, and we haven't got there yet. The scenery we find on these final stages won't keep us too long. The weather's getting dull, the thickening fog descends, and what little there is to see is hard to make out. We are seeking you, the one that's hiding behind all these screens, these disguises. But alas, we find you losing, region by region, everything worth having. Appearing as cells, you've lost all traces of your exalted human status, and almost all your colour, and you've gone all quiet. As we move in further, you're reduced to mere chemistry, to a play of molecules, to just one of those shadowy entities. Not a negligible or uninteresting embodiment, but quite dead, and hardly worth a funeral. And plucking up our courage and pushing further into the gloom, we find you really made of even more ghostly components, atoms. Reverting to one of your earlier disguises, you're a fair imitation of a solar system. Only this time, there's practically nothing to it or behind it. In no sense are its component particles things as we know them. Is there any conclusion to the systematic stripping of your assets? Your approach to absolute emptiness or nothingness? Is there any solution to the mystery of your ultimate building bricks? If there are any? And much more important, is there any remedy for the anxiety and frustration and perhaps sheer fright which can go with this unveiling, this cruel exposure, this undermining of all one's pretensions? How could there be a remedy for the aching void at the centre of the ninefold nest of boxes that you are? How could there be? Well, there is a remedy. And all you've got to do is turn round. You've been looking into the centre. Now look out of it. Right now you can see for yourself that the space where you are isn't mere space, empty space. Quite the contrary. It's space for the universe to happen in. Just look for yourself. At this moment, you're taking in, repeat, taking in. Your outstretched hands, that nine-veined model, and the furniture and walls of the room, and maybe the scene outside the window, grass, flowers, trees, houses, hills, clouds, sun, sky. Your cup had to be emptied before it could be filled. Your mirror had to be wiped clean before it could reflect the world. You had to come to nothing before everything could come to you. Yes, there is indeed a remedy for your condition, and a good half of your universe explorer exists to set it forth in some detail, on the inside of the veins this time. Now's the moment for getting back immensely more than you ever lost. Zooming in towards the centre, you lost just one galaxy, your Milky Way. Looking out now from the centre, you get all the others you want. On the inside of Vein 1, I show their four main types. Zooming in further, you lost just one star, your solar system. Looking out now, you gain a sky full of stars. Apologies to friends in the southern hemisphere for the limitations of Vein 2. Zooming in still further, you lost your dear and beautiful planet. Looking out, you gain seven beauties. On Vein 3, their relative sizes are right, their distances have been telescoped. Coming down to Earth, you lost sight of your own species, of humanity as a whole, and got a sight of thousands of others. Oh, how I wish that Vein 4 could do justice to their unbelievable wealth of colour and form and lifestyle. And then you traded just one face. Was it ever really yours? For those faces on Vein 5, for all the faces you'll ever take in. And so on. All very good business indeed. Whoever paid so little for so much, and all without ever stirring from the still, clear centre. John Milton has this description of you. He who has the clear light within his breast may sit at the centre and enjoy bright day. Did you ever leave that clear light, in fact, to make that long and often clouded journey to the centre, except in imagination? Well, that's almost the end of such guidance as I have to offer to universe explorers just now. I've introduced you to some of the scenery I've come across with this device as my vehicle. No, I don't expect you to pick on and thrill to all the features that appeal to me. But I guess you'll agree that the vehicle is pretty roadworthy, and that here's a tool for using, rather than a spectacle for looking at. For me, at least, it proves a technique for reopening old questions and posing new ones, for reviving one's childhood sense of wonder, for really enjoying the world. It has proved a key, an inspiration, a means of communication in which the medium truly is the message, an intellectual discipline, a handy filing system for sorting and storing data, a practical aid for living, even a teacher. Yes, how often it's been trying to tell me things I've been resisting but needed to recognise. And all this, I'm sure, because it literally makes sense. Because it's basically, and I certainly don't mean in every detail, sensitive to the given facts, humble before the evidence. And because you and I just happen to be built into the cosmos like this, and the cosmos just happens to be built like this into you and me. But the question remains, do you and I really need this sort of vision of ourselves, this view in depth? How practical is it for everyday living? Can we afford to give it a miss? Well, that's for us to try out. I would suggest, however, that living from what we see to be true about ourselves is more likely to work than living from what we see is untrue. And the truth here is certainly a tremendous one. Our model's about a revolution, a radical change in our status. It's about the dethroning of man as just man, and his enthroning as infinitely more than and less than man, as a native of all those levels and regions, thanks to their common ground and foundation in him. Above all, it's about shifting centre from vein 5, that region of the person, with all the masks that make up the personality, to the one and only true centre of all the regions. To that crystal sphere which has no preferences. In other words, it's about shifting from appearance to reality, from accident to essence. Shakespeare has this to say about the ridiculous and tragic consequences of not making that shift. Man, proud man, dressed in little brief authority, most ignorant of what is most assured, his glassy essence, like an angry ape, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep. Ape or essence, which shall it be? Vein 5, or the glassy centre, which includes all 9 veins? Certainly Shakespeare has no doubt about the practical necessity of investigating what we really are. I'll conclude with just one further illustration or thumbnail sketch of the insights or lines for research which this device can lead to. In the real and steeply contoured cosmos, in contrast to the ironed-out, conventional flatland we settled for, all the thrust and go of it, all actual process and communication, runs across those contours. It's represented by the 2 spindles of your universe, which alone hold the whole together and hold the veins apart. You'll recollect how you assemble the thing in the first place, by working up the lower spindle, threading on vein 1, and then a spacer, and then vein 2, and so on to the centre, and then repeating the operation with the upper spindle, with the result that's now in front of you. The circumferential display depends on the radial support. The world's work runs at right angles to its show. Here's an example. For my hammer actually to drive a nail, the hammerhead has to traverse the region where the nail manifests as a nail and come to regions where it's reduced to molecules and then atoms and particles and finally, at the point of contact, to no thing. Our old friend the Red Queen again, in fact. Equally, to be driven, the nail will not accept the hammer as such. The hammer's inward path to the nail is the hammer's undoing, destruction. Or again, suppose that one of those kids on vein 5 were to hit one of the others. You observe, maybe you film that first traversing uniform space till it lands on that nose. Nose and fist come together while remaining visibly, nose and fist, and there's no pain at all. Well, that's only shadow boxing, not a real punch, because it's a one-level, one-regional, circumferential appearance. Out there, pictures are powerless to change pictures. They just succeed one another. Well, that's not where the action is. But now supposing that aggressive kid, angry at you for filming his bad behaviour, smites you on the nose. This time, you see that fist growing rapidly and then fading out. And there's pain, all right. This isn't shadow boxing. It's the real thing. It's all right, though. Here is the space for that pain. You're quite safe. Nothing can touch that central you. And the same goes for each of those children. And for me, and for all beings. Right where you are at this moment, represented by that transparent sphere at the center of our universe model, is what's been called the incomparable safety. It's home, your home, and mine, and everyone else's. And it's also the launching pad, the faring forth, the incomparable daring. The cosmos is its adventure, your adventure. A fair wind and a prosperous voyage. Goodbye.